2021, time and past.
Here the Supreme Court is said. That is dealt with under Article 104, which says the voting quorum at one half of the membership of Parliament. Thus, I'm quoting, read together with Article 104.1, the quorum contemplated in Article 102 should be properly understood to mean the quorum for all other business of Parliament. Then it says quorum for voting, Article 104.1. That number cannot be less than 138. As poor as our maths and arithmetic is, less Adjoa Safo is 137, less one half of Parliament is equal to a charade of a decision that they think that is constitutionally right. Get it right, and we still were filing the stay of execution, which now has been properly and adequately filed. Therefore, the investor community should be interested in holding this government accountable. They said that I indicated that our country is tottering at the precipice of bankruptcy.
Right. So let's start from the very bottom. Mama Yarga, let's begin with Afenyoma Akin first. Why does such an important piece of legislation, most controversial, which has forced government, you have tried to pass it, you know, for a long time, and you have not been able to until this day. The government has been forced to literally go around the country, speak to people, to get them to buy in. And then it's smuggled in the way it was, without prior notice.
Okay. So, Samson, let me explain to you. The minority did a good work, unlike previous budgets where tax policy is introduced and it will be business as usual. So the work they did, that compelled us to explain issues to the Ghanaian people, to me, is commendable. And I've said this on a number of occasions. But as to whether or not we smuggled it in, my answer is we never smuggled anything in. We never surprised them. You know, every Friday, we read the business statement. The business statement has proposals for the ensuing week.
That's right.
You don't specifically advertise that you are going to take a particular bill. But in that, there's a provision where you write, you propose bills, papers will be laid. Bills that are already in our custody will be considered. So my respected colleague here knows that there are a lot of motions that are tabled. We never get to take them. But as and when they have to be programmed, that notice is served. Mm-hmm. So we serve them notice through the order paper. The order paper is the document we use in serving notice. If, as it were, it was not listed on the order paper, then you can say you've smuggled something in.
All right.
Even so, we do what we call order paper addendum. Right, so let me go to the next step.
So this was advertised?
It was just fully advertised.
The minority knew,
of course,
that this was coming on this day.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So we did it, and
they knew that it was coming on in a particular week.
Oh, I thought you would normally allow me to...
In a particular week, just to correct him, in a particular week. Not the particular
day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so the week started.
The business statement states.
Yeah, very well. So
this is what business will conduct this week.
All right. Yeah. Please proceed.
Now you're teaching me procedure. So the week started on Tuesday, and we advertised that to be taken, and they were adequately prepared for the business of the day. We agreed on the number to debate. We agreed on the time. And then, you know, when it got to Aaron Estein to debate, we noticed that they wanted to do, you know, something different. So, well, it's within their rights as Democrats to walk out. Mr. Speaker put the question at the time that the majority leader waived his right to make his own submission. And the question was put. They were walking out. Not all of them were out. But it's really not the matter, not the issue here. You see, in Parliament, there is always a presumption of regularity until an issue is raised.
Only in Parliament.
Well,
in every institution,
institution,
the law presumes
the regularity unless it you are forced to raise a concern,
right.
And then the law will go into it.
Mm.
So, when they were leaving, if you listen to Honorable Harun Edrisu, they never raised any issue of quorum. They only said they were not participating. So they left. But if you exit the chamber, it doesn't mean that your exit will stop public business.
Mm.
It is never the case. They tried to compare what happened in December. At that time, there was division. A division had been called, and Mr. Speaker had ruled on it. So they were doing the counting. And if they take their time to read the Supreme Court ruling carefully, they realize that whatever they are trying to do there now would, with the greatest respect, amount to nothing.
Mm.
Because...
You said it didn't mean anything for them to walk out.
Well, it didn't affect public business.
Mm. But why was the majority leader shouting, put the question. He said there are some of them still in the house. Put the question.
No,
why was he in a hurry to get that done?
It is within his right to say that I am not. And they were making noise. So Mr. Speaker, if you watch the video, Speaker said he could not hear. So he said, Mr. Speaker, I have waived my right to speak. Then Mr. Speaker repeated it, the Honorable Majority Leader, are you saying you are waiving your right? So I even got up.
Mm.
I got up to the clerk at table to tell him that is the position. So Mr. Speaker should put the question.
Is it not the case that he wanted the question to be put before they had completely left the chamber? Because if they did, then the question of quorum will hunt you. So he wanted to be sure. And initially, we heard some of you say that by the time the question was put, there were as many as 30 of the NDC MPs still in the house who had not completely left.
No, I think it was in response to the argument that they had left.
Mm.
But to me, that is really not the issue. You see, the issue of counting arises only when it is raised.
Okay.
So to me, it doesn't matter. It amounts to nothing.
Mm.
Look, what
does it matter though that the minority leader announces in unequivocal terms that they will have absolutely nothing to do with the process?
It's a mere political statement. It doesn't affect the procedure.
Mm.
It's a mere political statement.
The House is a house of record.
Of course. So if you
does
say...
it take note of that record?
If you say that you would have nothing to do with it,
mm-hmm.
yet you sit in or you walk out, you won't participate. It's your right that you've waived. Should that stop business of the day? No, it cannot.
I'm asking because you seem to suggest that unless the question of quorum or lack of it is raised,
yes,
there is no issue. But even where there is an issue is raised, it cannot be said that there was no quorum.
I don't understand your question. The last part of it, I don't understand it.
If the issue of quorum is raised,
right,
it is possible to say that the minority, whilst they announced that they were walking out, could not be said to have left the house.
Well, hypothetically,
mm-hmm.
let me hesitate a bit in the kind of answer I want to give because I really don't understand your question. But the point here is, they participated in the proceedings, except to say that at the point they left the chamber. I am saying that they could have stayed in to raise the issue of quorum. They didn't. We've passed the student loans amendment bill. We have also dealt with the Criminal Offences Act. We've also amended. When we're doing that, we're just about 20 or so. The Criminal Offences Act, just a few of us. Are they saying that there was no issue of quorum? The Student Loans Act that we amended. Go back to 1993.
You have amended to take away guarantorship.
That is correct, sir. Mm. Go back to 1993. When it comes to actual lawmaking, the bills, people will be walking in and out. That's why Mr. Speaker gave an interpretation to what to him, by our practice, constitutes presence in the House.
Okay.
And all that.
All right.
So, well, I don't understand why they think that by merely walking out, they would ambush us and that we lack quorum. Let's put that aside. And granted that they are right. You know, on that day, because the decision on Kwesi had sufficed, they themselves, Kwesi was in the office, they didn't allow him to come in. Right. They themselves told him that until the stay of execution process was duly filed, and we're also monitoring in Cape Coast, they themselves told him that don't enter the chamber. So he did not. At that point, the number was 274. Because Kwesi's election had been nullified. The number for taking decision couldn't have been 275.
Interesting.
The number, because they themselves stopped Kwesi. So if you listen to Haruna, Haruna said that now Kwesi's appeal stay of it has been properly filed.
Why are we hearing you argue this interesting point
today? But we are dealing with the issue. This is the first time you've given me an opportunity to argue this. Mm. So Kwesi was in parliament.
Because this is significant.
Of course, I know. It is. And they know it is. Kwesi was there, but they stopped him from entering the chamber because they know that it was going to be illegal. But I'm telling you that at that relevant point in time, at that material point in time, our number was 274, not 275. Okay? So that one, they should bear that in mind. Third, justiciability of their process at the Supreme Court. I want to refer to...
We'll get back to that. Yes.
So,
Mama, now explain to us, as we understand now from Dr. Dominic Ayene, you were sort of the man behind that, you know, idea. You were the architecture of that idea that let's work out. Let's not be part of this quote-unquote bloody business to burden Ghanaians.
Yeah, okay. So
hindsight.
Oh no, not really. You see, for several months now, we've been fighting the passage of the e-levy. We started the fight from the budget itself, because we said, okay, if you're against the principle and the principle is captured in the budget, and you approve the budget, then implicitly you are accepting the principle. So it was the principle of the e-levy itself that made us to try to reject the entire budget.
You have said it from day one that you will have nothing to do with it.
Yes, we have. And we will oppose it using whatever means is available to us. And so we have been strategizing and strategizing based on what we thought were the arsenals at our disposal, including fighting, throwing chairs, preventing the first deputy speaker from voting at one instance. We are roundly condemned for it, and etc. We've been fighting with all the commitment that we could marshal. On this particular day, we felt that we had been denied of one of our votes, okay? And we also, at that time, so if we denied one of our votes, we're looking at the mathematics. So we will be 136 and they will be 137. So if they are 137 or 136, then clearly they will win the vote. Now, a lot of people say, stand and vote and be counted and let them see that you have voted and, you know, you've lost through a vote. But at that material time, our calculation was that it's not, we're not fighting so that people will see that we are fighting. We're fighting to actually try and stop the passage of the legislation. So if we thought that the best tool to prevent the passage of the legislation is to try and prevent the existence of a quorum so that it will further be another stumbling block in the way of passing the bill, the levy, then we should deploy it. And that was the thinking that, that informed the strategy. And we did the calculations, and then we said, okay, work out. It was something we debated among ourselves. There were those who felt, you know, just stand and be counted, and then, you know, let Ghanaians see that you voted against it, and they won using their numbers, and et cetera. That's the end of it. So the group that felt, let's deploy another tool and see how that works, won the day that let's work out based on consultation among us. So I just want people to know that the story out there that, oh, minority was compromised and this and that, I mean, if we wanted to be compromised, we would have been compromised long ago.
By who?
Exactly. If we wanted to be compromised, we would have been compromised long ago. I mean, you know that on several occasions, we've come to the floor of the House to say the roads in our constituencies are need construction. And the roads minister has come to the floor to say, well, I mean, we need to do your roads. That's why we need E-levy.
But that's not, that doesn't amount to compromise.
Exactly. So, no, but it can be a reason why if I feel that, okay, this funding can help with infrastructure in my constituency, to help with the person who is paying, since I get a road in my constituency, let me compromise.
Mm.
So I'm saying that if we wanted to be
One very terrible thing about our democracy, the executive hold, so that in the country, literally nothing works unless the executive says it will work, as far as financing is concerned.
Exactly.
Right.
So we've fought it with real commitment because we felt Ghanaians didn't want it and were willing to stand with them in that moment. So that is it. We walked out believing that based on the Supreme Court ruling,
they will be left with...
You will need a quorum of 138 to be able to take a decision.
And at the time, they had only...
And at the time, they didn't have 138.
But okay. They had what?
Now
we are, the number was...
So far as...
Wait, don't go there yet.
So far as our records show, in the chamber, they only had 136. So far as our records show.
Because of the absence of Adjoa Safo.
Because of the absence of Adjoa Safo in the chamber.
Right.
And the absence of the chieftaincy minister in the chamber.
They dispute that the chieftaincy minister was in the chamber.
He was not in the chamber. There are cameras, and the cameras will show.
But if you want to...
There are cameras, and the cameras will show. He was not in the chamber. He never entered the chamber.
You are talking about cameras. Sisala West.
Okay. Now, I think hold on for me. Note that point.
I'm saying.
Sisala West and Savelu. You are introducing cameras.
I'm saying that there were 136.
There were 136
members of parliament in the chamber at the time they went through consideration stage and third reading.
Yeah, and you see, would have needed 138.
That's our position.
So because of the absence of Adjoa Safo, you say also of the chieftaincy minister, that's what they
were 136 in the chamber.
All right.
And that is our case.
What's about yours?
That's our case. That's our case.
Right.
Is that the case?
So that's a question he just
that's
asked. How do you answer to that? How about your side?
How many were you in the chamber?
Well, I mean, I'm telling you what our case is before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And we...
Yeah, I know that's substantive, yes. But information, we just want to know,
yes.
What was the number of the minority in the House?
I'm saying that we are looking at our case on the question of quorum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
We are not talking about the Supreme Court case now. Yes. I said we'll get there.
Now listen.
You've heard it out there in the public.
Yeah, listen carefully.
Among the accusation is that, number one, some said...
Let me explain that. The minority had been stampeded. No.
You had been surprised.
Yeah.
Some of your members had been invited to the Tamale flyover. We call it interchange. I don't know why we call it interchange.
That's not
because
true.
It's a one-way
Everybody
tool.
Was there. Everybody was there.
Right.
Except question and, that wasn't in the chamber.
Right.
Let me explain to you.
Okay.
We were 136 NDC members of parliament.
Because of Kwesi.
There were 136 MPP members of parliament in the chamber.
Okay.
But they had the chieftaincy minister outside the chamber. If we were going to stay and vote, they would have brought the chieftaincy minister in.
Mm.
And that would have made them 136.
Now you are clarifying.
Are you getting the
same
point?
Same way you also
they
have
would have,
two
they would have brought him in, and there would have been 137.
So okay. You also have two
outside now, now, hold on,
the chamber.
Hold on.
In the case,
hold
on, in the Martin, case of records, in the case of the Kwesi, Kwesi had a legal objection. We talked about Kwesi. We talked about forcefully bringing Kwesi in. And then we came to a conclusion, even if we forcefully bring Kwesi in, afterwards, they could go to court and get the court to determine that Kwesi's vote should be taken out.
Mm.
And we'll still be reduced to 136.
Okay,
and
now,
their 137 will stand.
Mm.
So this is the calculation. So
now
those,
he's
who argue,
you.
Those who argue that, oh, but if they were 136 and you were 136, why didn't you stay to vote? And then there will be a tie.
Mm.
There wouldn't have been a tie because they would have wheeled in.
You would have formed the quorum.
They would have wheeled in. No.
Okay.
First, would have formed the quorum. And secondly, they would have wheeled in the chieftaincy minister.
Okay.
When we walked out, it didn't occur to them to still wheel in the chieftaincy minister.
Okay, now hold
to meet
on.
This
yes,
quorum
now,
of 137.
Right, right. Now hold on. What do you say when he brings in? It's a seminal point, I think. He says.
Yes, I'm telling you. Our response to that.
Yes, the reason Kwesi was not brought in.
Yes.
Was a legal question.
Yes.
A legal technical question.
Yes.
And that is that, long before now, the Cape Coast High Court had determined that he was ineligible. He could not be an MP. So the House was no longer left with 275. In that regard, what will be the number required for quorum? So it appears that if they raise this point, they shoot your suit down.
No, they won't. That's why we say that at the very material time, there were 136 in the chamber. They had a chieftaincy minister outside. It didn't occur to them that to constitute a quorum, they needed to bring the chieftaincy minister into the chamber.
Mm.
Okay?
Okay.
Why?
Okay.
They are the ones who say he was in the ambulance outside. Mm. Is the ambulance part of the chamber?
In your suit.
Is the ambulance part of the
Let's talk about it. In your suit, what did you say is the quorum in your suit? What did you say is the number they needed to form a quorum?
We take a position that the Supreme Court said you must be at least a majority of all members of parliament. And we say that the Supreme Court pronounced 130, at least half of all the members of parliament. And the Supreme Court pronounced that it is 138.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we say in our suit.
Right.
Okay. Now,
so if you agree to the argument he raises now,
yes,
the number you need for quorum is not 138.
Yes.
How do you surmount that?
How do we surmount that?
Yeah.
We surmount that by establishing factually that even if the number is 137, as he is positing, in the chamber, there were 136. So they didn't even meet the 137 quorum.
How do you answer to his question, which is legal again, about presumption of regularity? You know the law, that there is a presumption of regularity unless it is rebutted. As far as what they did was concerned in the official business.
That's why it is called a presumption.
Right.
A presumption can be rebutted by evidence.
Exactly.
So if we have evidence of video cameras showing that there were just 136 members of parliament sitting in the chamber, that presumption is rebutted.
Was there the need?
It's a presumption.
Was there the need for somebody to raise Was there the need for somebody to raise the question of lack of quorum before this kicks in?
For me, following the Supreme Court decision, the key issue is whether there's evidence that you actually have 138 people in the chamber. Following the Supreme Court decision, and if the number is reduced by one that he is claiming, whether you had 137 in the chamber.
You expected the speaker to count the number before he started the decision.
I have said that several times. I think even in this studio, your PM Express, we expected the speaker at all times to ascertain the quorum before he proceeds. On the basis of the Supreme Court prompting, the fact that the Supreme Court makes a clear distinction between ordinary quorum and quorum to take decision. So at decision taking time, at every decision taking time, any speaker presiding ought to convince himself and establish that there is in fact a quorum.
And at
so
the last
whether
time,
somebody prompts you
at the last
or
time,
not,
at the last time,
yes, and at the last time,
with regards to the approval of the budget,
when they walked out, the speaker told us, and every Ghanaian was watching, that he wanted to convince himself that he had a quorum.
Why was that so?
Because he felt that he needed to.
No, because somebody had asked for a division.
So if you ask for a division, does that raise a question of quorum? A division doesn't raise a question of quorum.
It's because you doubt the number.
Listen carefully. A division was because, you see, when you do voice vote and then you put the question,
right,
you may not hear. And the numbers are almost equal, okay? You may not be able to tell from the voices which side is the majority. When you have 137, 138, or 137 in the chamber, and at that time it was 137, 137, because that they were also waiting for Ajosafo. So 137, they were 137. And then they had two ministers in. That was the finance minister, and then the minister of state and minister of finance.
Okay.
And we said that, look, if these two people's voices add, their voice would drown ours.
That's fine.
So I wanted all of them out, so that it would be the 137.
That's appreciated.
So, yes.
I want us to go to the substance of.
Yes. So the law. The reason why it wasn't the division that caused the speaker to count. He just wanted to be sure that he had a quorum.
Right.
And so we take a position that before we walked out, he should also have ascertained whether he had a quorum.
Okay.
And he would have established that there was no quorum.
Thank you. Martin, let's bring in Martin. Martin, can you briefly share your view on this quorum question and the numbers as the House was left with that Afeoma King raises? And how that impacts, if you like, on the suit in the Supreme Court. Hello, Martin.
Yes, hello.
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, yes, I must mention that, to be honest with you, this matter is one that I'm not exactly clear which argument is better. I say so because you see, we are all clear in our minds that usually by parliamentary practice, if you don't raise a matter of quorum, it's presumed that there is quorum.
Regularity. So presumption of regularity.
Excellent. Yes. And the Supreme Court has time with our number upheld such a presumption. Okay. Yes. Now, but because of the recent Abdullahi case, I'm like, oh, then perhaps it's true that there is a change. Yes, because I've looked at it, and I'm like, so the best is what they've done. Let's see what the court decides. Because, you see, the truth of the matter is that it's also not good for our democracy that anytime, let's say, one side sees that they are about to lose a vote, then they will stage a walkout. For me, you know, I really find it difficult to appreciate that tactic. Yes, it's true. Somebody will say, yes, it's a tool of their game. But, you know, for us as lawyers, we don't like fraud. So when you see defeat staring in your face and you can run out, it doesn't really avoid that defeat. It doesn't, you know, aligned with fraud as we practice.
Are you saying that, well, this is a democracy, so majority will always win, therefore the decision by the minority was wrong? They should have stayed in there and make their voices heard.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the matter of the quorum, okay, if you don't raise it, then by parliamentary procedure, it's said to exist, okay? But here is the case, we have a new Supreme Court decision, and that decision, you see, reading it and saying that there should be at least 138 present, I like it because it appears on the face of it that that one now overrides the parliamentary practice that if you don't, you don't raise quorum, it's presumed to exist.
Martin, sincerely, what has the Abdullahi case introduced? Has he introduced anything to the rule about the number you need to take a decision in parliament? Has it?
On the face of it, it appears so, because they are making it clear. You see,
the Constitution in Article 104, forgive me, the Constitution in Article 104.1 says, except as otherwise provided in this constitution, matters in parliament shall be determined by the votes of the majority of members present and voting, with at least half of all the members of parliament present. Did the Supreme Court say anything different from this?
But you know that.
Yes. So, Sam, this is what is different. You see, they've been telling you, even after the Supreme Court decision, that they are able to take decisions with fewer than 100 parliamentarians present, once nobody raises the matter. And so the difference is that because of the Abdullahi decision, if you take any decision where you had less than 138, the other side can go and complain. So let's see what the Supreme Court says.
I don't understand this. The law says you need at least half of all of the members to take a decision.
Yes.
You have been breaking that law.
Excellent.
Somebody goes to the court and the court confirms that. Keep to the law. You say the court has said anything different. It has not.
It has, because there is a difference. It has said keep to the law. And even after that decision, did you hear Honorable Afenyo Martin say that when they were passing the Student Loans Act amendment, there were just about 20 of them?
Of course.
Nobody said anything, so no problem. But as and when somebody decides to say something, let's see what the court will say. We are all learning.
Take a decision with less than, I'm putting the question in a different way and finally, if you take a decision with less than half of all members present, are you breaching the Constitution or you are breaching a Supreme Court ruling?
Oh, okay, Sam, give me a minute. You see? It's neither of those if nobody complains. Sam, listen, neither of those if nobody complains. But if somebody complains, then a decision must be taken by the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
That's it.
All right, thank you. So, what do you think of what they are doing, they are seeking to do in the courts? Your mic is off. No, there's a problem. I can't hear you. The mic is on now, but I can't hear you. Try speaking. No. Okay.
Hello?
Yes. Did I hear him? Yes, you are on.
Okay. Sorry. So the question, I think in the process I've lost.
Yes,
it.
I was asking what you think of proceeding to the Supreme Court over this.
Yes, so that it will be clear in our mind what it is. Because already, Sam, let's not forget that that decision in itself, as I've said elsewhere, to the extent that Parliament didn't have a say in it, that decision, it's not complete in my estimation, because they didn't receive arguments from all angles. Okay? So indirectly, through this new suit, then we hear from Parliament, and I think even apart from this the Supreme Court ought to invite Parliament itself to present an amicus curiae brief. Let's hear all the argument. For me, this second suit will bring finality to the matter, so that we'll know the application of the 138, meaning that must it always be 138, whether somebody raises it or not, or Parliament's practice that if nobody says anything, even 10 people can decide, should continue to apply. That's it.
All right. Afenyo raises a question that at the time, the number as Parliament stood was no longer 275. What do you say about that argument?
At what material point?
On the day, and as we speak, until and unless Judge Kwesing had filed his stay of execution of the judgment. Because, you know, he had filed that earlier, and that was keeping him in the house. Yeah. And then that was thrown out, but he had to file it again.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So for me, at the material point, you see, Honorable Idris mentioned that his stay had now been properly filed. So meaning that he could then participate.
Not at the time of this decision.
No, but I thought the time Haruna was talking, was that not before they stayed the workout?
After.
If it had been filed at the time, very obviously they would have allowed him to go into the house.
Hey.
Into the chamber. But they did not.
Yeah. Oh no, Sam, let's hold back this. Haruna rises and informs the whole world that Kwesing's application has now been properly filed.
That's not in the chamber.
Press conference.
That's at a press conference.
After the decision.
After the decision, really, at a press conference.
Oh, okay. So meaning that at the time they were working out, Kwesing was not packed.
Exactly.
Exactly. So at that time, if Kwesing is not part, they didn't also have Adua Safo, and then the other MP was said to be outside. Do we have evidence that the MP was brought in? If he wasn't brought in.
He was in.
He was not brought in.
Mama Yarga says he was not brought in.
Not that I
said. Afenyo Makin disagrees that he was brought in.
No, he wasn't brought in.
But there were journalists there. Sam, this is how I will go on this matter.
Exactly.
There were journalists there.
Yes.
I would be extremely shocked that this man was being taken in a stretcher and no journalist captured it. So on that basis, I think I want to believe that he wasn't brought in.
Okay, so you sincerely think that this suit serves any value, any purpose?
Extremely. It's good. Let it clear the doubts once and for all. And especially, we'll implore the Supreme Court this side to let Parliament come in. Let's get full argument. Because,
the decision
usually is eroded. The value of this is eroded if a huge constituency, a huge stakeholder, is not heard in coming to a decision. I mean, can you imagine? There's a decision affecting how Parliament conducts its business.
All right.
And Parliament was never heard.
Okay. Let's get to Dr. Kenneth Shigbe and also Theo Echampong, who have just joined us. And let's get to the e-levy proper. So we were taking a cue, if you like, from other countries. In Uganda, they introduced the same thing, and it was 1%. 1%, not like what we sought to do. After public protest, it was reduced from 1% to 0.5%. In the Congo, it was also introduced at 1%. Yeah. After public protest, it was replaced with cash outs only. So you are liable to pay only when you are cashing out. And that appears to me is actually an incentive to keep electronic transactions. So you stay on to transact business electronically rather than taking cash out. In Cote d'Ivoire, they introduced it at 0.5%. After the protest, it was withdrawn. In Malawi, they introduced it at 1%. After protest, it was withdrawn. In Benin, they introduced it at 5%. But on only Momo operators, that was implemented despite widespread public opposition. And then in Cameroon, it was introduced at 0.2%, and it remains at 0.2%. Dr. Ken Achigbe, why is it that here in Ghana, in spite of the widespread outcry, opposition, which forced the hand of this government to go back and try and explain to people, and we know how cosmetic that's going around and explaining was. We still are keeping to what we have, although reducing it from 1.7 to 1.5.
Thank you, Samso. But you will be asking me to be clairvoyant and be able to read the mind of the Minister for Finance. I am not the Minister for Finance, so I would not know why they've kept it. But we, as an industry, I remember in 2019, you know, we issued a paper on mobile money and that whole industry and how to be able to drive a bit more revenue from it. And, you know, so our position have always been the fact that do not tax mobile money itself. And that position really is informed by what we have seen happen in other places, and also because of government's own strategies in pushing the digitalization agenda. Government makes the point of, you know, the physical challenge that we have and needing other revenues. But the point also has to be made that in terms of the plethora of issues that we raised, government has taken some of them. Some of them are still outstanding. So, for example, in terms of the rates, you know, we thought that if really we wanted to do this, definitely the 1.5 is even high. And you know, the example of Uganda you gave, you know, even though they have even reduced it to the 0.5, they still have not recovered the challenges that they have faced with the pushback. But so because of all of that as well, government has introduced a lot of things that they put in to be able to try and mitigate the challenge and not affect financial inclusion. So the exemption of the 100 Ghana CDs, you know, initially merchant payments were part of it. Merchant payments have been taken out of it, .gov payments. But I also have to concede that as of now, I've not even seen the final bill that was passed by Parliament that has been assented to the president. So I'm not too sure what the details in all of that is. But interestingly, some of these things that have been introduced to be able to make it mitigate the effect is also introducing complexities that would make the implementation of you know, the law itself by GRA and the operators very difficult. Let me give you a typical simple example. It will now mean that before you do any mobile money, if you're on the USSD platform, the system should be able to check that you have all the transactions you have done is less than 100 Ghana CDs. That if you had used that, some of your transactions to pay taxes to government, that should be taken out. It has to go and see whether you have done any transaction on another mobile money account. You have used your mobile money account to do a merchant POS, done payment on the POS, done banking. And you know, if you take the USSD that has majority of mobile money, you need just a few seconds, otherwise it will time out. So it's really going to be important that we try and start as simply as possible, you know, so that it does not become a bottleneck. So the concerns that you raised are very, they've happened in other places and they could easily happen here. And so in terms of the implementation, we need a lot of time to be able to really do it. But I cannot speak to why the finance minister still went ahead despite the issues that we raised.
The point is that there has been a reduction from what originally was contemplated. How should people also welcome that? Because it does appear that too many people don't take that for anything. It doesn't mean anything to them.
Well, you see, Samson, speaking as a social scientist again, and then also as a physical scientist, as an engineer, you know, you've looked at the empirical evidence from other markets. You really, none of the markets have really started at 1.5. It has to be given that some of our members who currently have charges have also promised to, you know, take some of their charges off. So the jury really is out there in terms of the risk and the unintended consequences that have come. So for us as an industry, one of the things we have been preaching is that what can we do to ensure that some of these unintended consequences do not crystallize? So the point you make about the rate is definitely a genuine one. You know, I'm pretty sure that maybe government's argument would then be to see, we look at how it goes, and then if it does not go well, maybe we could reduce it. So that could be the opposite of your penetrative pricing, where you would go low and then gradually increase it. You know, all of that are are things that I'm sure could be are being considered. But that is definitely a genuine risk, because and especially one of the things that we had also been advocating and speaking to government about is the fact that the whole industry, the way it's structured, charges are capped at a particular point. So for mobile money, those who charge, if you do beyond 1,000 CDs, you pay 10 CDs and not more. For some banks, I bank with Fidelity when I use the app as well, your charge is capped. You know, the maximum you can pay is 10 CDs. But now with the way it's structured, it means that if you want to do, you know, now after COVID, in terms of how much transactions you've made has been increased. So if you want to send, say, a 5,000, 1.5% of a 5,000, it's quite significant. And you constantly have to be looking at what alternatives exist, you know, because it's better for government to get a little bit of the tax than people do avoidance, which is legal, and government will not get it. If the banks, bank transfers from person to person is still in there, then it means that, and the exemption at the last time I thought was that it was only corporates that were not going to be affected. If you have to, if you are buying land from a friend, which is not a corporate, and you are sending money to them, 100,000, 1.5 of 100,000 is very significant. People would then have to find other ways in which this has to be done. So we need to bear that in mind, that in as much as government wants to be able to generate some revenue, the alternative and the enemy, which is cash, still exists and is the thing that a lot of people know and is the thing that people will fall back to naturally. So how do we do all of this? Even if we agree to do it, how do we do it in such a way that we don't mitigate it? The example of the Congo is a great one, because you see, cash out is the thing we want to disincentivize. So when you see the vice president talk about QR code and talk, makes the example of the watch a person, you know, where you are using a QR code to purchase it. Mm-hmm. It's because when the money gets onto the wallet, you know, people should be able to keep it on the wallet, not just go cash it out and still be able to use it. Because what that does is that it enhances traceability, enhances the information that the monetary policy people and the fiscal policy people can get to aid their planning. And I'm happy government has, you know, taken out some of the merchant payments out, so that, you know, you then at the end of the day, when the merchant, you know, that is a merchant SIM, then all transactions that are on that particular merchant SIM are turned over for the person. Mm-hmm. The person will just have to put his cost for you to determine the profit the person has made. And then you can apply corporate income tax, which is definitely more than 1.5%, and then be able to then tax at the point of profit, not production. So those are some of the things, the arguments we have made, that if we want to really make sure that the digital platform, which is becoming, you know, is growing and growing, contributes also to taxation and all of that, let's do it in such a way that we don't roll back some of the great things that governments over the years have done in terms of our digitalization, and still be able to get some of the revenue and not, you know, make sure incentivize cash. So those for us are some of the challenges that currently exist. I know also that at the last conversation we had, you know, as we're preparing our minds, you know, waiting for Parliament to pass this particular law, GRA was agreeing that it was going to, instead of at the per person level, do a per wallet to start with, so that it makes it simpler to be able to implement. And so I'm hoping that what we're going to do, so that in terms of if all the issues are sorted out and it has to be done, it can be done, it can be engineered in a simple manner, and then the complexities can be introduced as we go along.
All right. Thank you. Let me go to Theo Echampong again. We're looking at the mechanics and the fear that, this will drive down the agenda of digitization or digitalization and electronic, transactions. But when I return, there's something, Martin, I almost missed that I would like you to, because anytime we have discussed this issue about the filing of a process in the court that automatically sort of stays somebody's hand, I remember you have been referring to an authority by the Supreme Court to the effect that the mere filing of the execution, stay of execution, does not change the fact that the MP has been so declared that he's not an MP, and therefore he cannot be in Parliament. It is interesting. So I'll come to you. I want to go to this man and come back to you.
All right.
And then I find also that before the court, in the recent case, the Attorney General argued that anything other than ensuring that there is that number, 138, in Parliament before a decision is taken, will be manifestly unwarranted violence against the provisions of the Constitution. Yes, Dr. Theo Echampong, let's hear you about the fears and whether you think that this should have been redrawn. And now that it is passed, how should we go about it?
Good morning, once again. My position on Momo, I think is very clear, and it's been within the public domain, that I don't think that we necessarily need it. Nevertheless, the government has passed it, and the question is, how do you ensure that it doesn't derail the digital inclusion agenda? The point really here is the fact that the government assumes that the consumption of mobile money services, to put it in economic terms, we say it's inelastic demand. So basically, if people want the convenience of utilizing that service, and that doesn't really push them enough, even if you put 1.5 or whatever tax on it, to want to substitute. But if you actually look at the two data points recently from the Bank of Ghana's quarterly statistics, so every quarter they have this data that they release called the Summary of Economic and Financial Data. If you look at November, when the idea was originally proposed, the total value of Momo transactions was about 86 billion Ghana cedis. In December of last year, it dropped to 82.9 billion. And then in January of this year, that's the latest data point we have, is actually 76.2 billion. So over the course of about 3 months, we've almost seen a 10-12% reduction in the value of the transactions that are taking place. And what this indicates to me is the fact that we're actually seeing some sort of reaction by consumers to the policy proposal and the announcement. So definitely, I think in the short to medium term, the value and the volume of transactions would come down as consumers adjust to this. And I think certainly you actually would see a lot more cash now being utilized within the system, which would serve as a disincentive to the whole digital inclusion agenda. And that is a challenge that the government, faces. Because
Is there something to learn from this country, that is Congo, where they introduce it at 1%? After the protests, they replace it with only cash outs. If you are cashing out, then you pay the fee. Is there something there to learn?
That is something which is interesting, right? And that you only would pay the tax when you're cashing out. But fundamentally, the point also is that you already have paid for the service anyway. So why are you still being asked to pay money or being paid a tax on something that you already have paid to procure that service, right? So philosophically or fundamentally, I struggle to even accept the concept of having to pay this, you know, tax on something that you already have paid for, or the tax in that sense. But we also recognize the fact that the government says they need money. And in the Congo case, yes, they replace that with only when you do cash out and you are not paying any tax on the money or the balance which is sitting in your wallet. Mm. I don't think in the Ghana case that's what pertains, because I've looked at what was read on the House.
So, Doc, my question is there something we can learn from that? So that if, after all, we are going to have to use this policy, this law, because it's law now, another way to ensure that we don't take, you know, a downward, you know, trajectory as regards our electronic transactions, which is what we need for a digitized economy.
I will be honest with you. I don't think that the state officials are going to do that. Mm. I think they're going to fully roll out the policy, and then maybe a few months or down the line, it might come to the point where we actually see that downward reduction in the consumption of the services, and then they'll call the stakeholders around the table, and some of these policy proposals may come back to the table, including from, you know, the telecoms chamber, some of the ideas that Ken was talking about. But where I sit, really the challenge now is that the government needs money, and it needs money badly to be able to support the economy. If you look at the fiscal numbers that are coming through in the last quarter, I remember a few months ago, we were on this very platform where the state officials said that the deficit, the public debt, rather, as we speak, is below 80%. And some of us were actually saying that if you run the numbers and you do the projections by the end of last year, it was way above 80%. Tell you what, you look at the Bank of Ghana's data points that they released, and it's actually end of year 2021, the deficit was 80.1%, close to what a number of us had indicated, and even the likes of Bloomberg and Reuters had, you know, reported about. So that is the challenge that we are confronted with. And I think really the emphasis now on the side of the state is more about revenue and less about, you know, digital inclusion or trying to soften the blow for consumers, all of that. Right. Probably what will happen, and which I'm sort of quite clear in my mind about is, if we see that reduction in the consumption of the service, then in a few months' time, we may be back to the policy table to look at how we tweak the implementation of the ERP.
Okay, I'm looking at it from this point of view that once it's become law, and we need to go ahead, it's going ahead anyway. There's a need to find ways to avoid, you know, anti-electronic transaction conduct. And it does appear that in that regard, some lessons may be taken from the Congo situation, where you are punished for withdrawing cash. Do you think that is something that the government may think about to avoid what is already happening? We have seen queues. We don't know how authentic they are. We have seen queues, videos of queues, people going to their to vendors trying to take out their monies from their wallet.
Well, but eventually, the nature of transactions that we do these days, we would have little choice. And the fact that people would want to, for the convenience of it, rely on Momo. What I think government has been focusing on is the infrastructure that would ensure transparent and reliable system of collection.
Mm.
But again, from the politics of it, I chair the road fund, and I know that the road, the construction subsector of the economy is a major area that if we properly tackle it, would help grow our own economy. Because Samson, you have a contractor who gets a contract, gets a job done, takes a loan from the bank, and is not paid for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and will now have to depend on Goro Boys. The funds that come, sometimes you don't know who to pay. You have huge IPCs. But with this, the arrangement that is being put in place would ensure certainty that the funds are in, the banks will be happy with to finance the contractors because they have a long value chain.
Mm.
When you give a job to a contractor, he's employing an artisan, an unskilled labor, the watches seller gets job, the carpenter will get a job, and if the job is for 18 months, the whole lot of value chain that would get opportunity. So yes, it is not palatable to be talking about tax.
Mm.
You know, my wife calls me, say, Mr. E-Levy. You know, when I get said, Mr. E-Levy.
Even your wife.
She's been teasing me. Yes, I mean, nobody would want to be taxed.
Right.
That is true.
Mm.
But what we have to do, given the times we're in, is take advantage of the opportunity and reassure Ghanaians. Mm. Now look, just as we did, I mean, when we introduced free SHS, we didn't introduce a free SHS levy. We meant well. This has become a necessary evil. Therefore, now we are going to tell you how we're using the money. Two ways, the roads and the entrepreneurship support to the youth. No, Sam George had an amendment, though he was not in. We carried it. The one that will require the finance minister to be reported on how funds are disbursed. We took it on, though he was not in the chamber.
Okay.
But we found wisdom in that amendment he had proposed.
The thing I'm talking about is that myself, unconsciously, once it was passed and I'm beginning to do transactions on Momo, unconsciously it strikes me that you lose some money. You know?
Yes.
So I'm saying...
But over time...
I'm saying...
When we are showing to the people of Ghana that, look, transparently, this is how your monies are being spent. And I think that is...
the calculation, and it can be a lot of money for certain people, for certain transactions. So it is possible that in the near future, to avoid, you know, destroying the digitalization of the economy and transactions, you may contemplate introducing one other layer so that if you are going to cash out, you rather pay a hefty penalty for it.
So that it stops you from wanting to take your money. But I think that's a very technical thing, and it also, you know, makes sense. So that people will not take advantage.
So that they are forced to stay on electronic transactions.
I agree, but don't let us also forget that telcos were charging us 2%.
Some
telcos were charging us 2% without any legislation.
Samson, please.
Yes.
No telco has charged anybody 2%. You know, please. The charge was 1% when you sent. The next person is sold to the one percent goes to different people, and also the charges is a spectrum of charges. It's not 2%.
Can I don't misconstrue the point? Wait, don't let us split heads on this. I do Momo. I send Momo to my constituents. It's 1% here, 1% there. Understand it in an ordinary language, not in the technical space.
We understand them because they are doing us a service.
It's a service being provided. Already when you do it, you will get charged 1% when you are sending, when you are receiving is also 1%. I mean, that's it.
Okay.
So,
right.
I think that...
Now, hold on. I'm coming to Ayarga now, but let me go back to Martin. Martin, I ask you that question that I felt we left out. In the case itself, this one point that Afenyo and his team may want to pay attention to. In arguing before the court in the suit that has brought us the results that some are very unhappy about, the Attorney General said, the number of members of parliament who must be present before a decision is made, must be present before a decision is made, which is set as at least half of all the members of parliament for the current composition of parliament, that is 275 members. Yeah. That number clearly must be 138. Thus, for the purposes of Article 104, i.e. taking a decision on any matter in Parliament, at least 138 members must be present. And out of this number, a majority must have voted on the issue. Any other construction will manifestly do unwarranted violence to the clear words of that provision. So I just want the majority to avert their mind to that could also come up whether or not there was a counting or there was not. But my question to you was, Jachi Kwesing being brought in there, whether or not at the time the decision was being taken, they had filed a stay. You know that fact, that merely filing an application for the stay, that's not, it's not good enough.
And Sam, okay, I get it. This one is stay of execution, so this is good enough.
Okay.
It's the stay of proceedings that the mere filing is not good enough.
Okay.
So for stay of execution, as soon as you file, it takes effect until the court says, dismisses your application.
All right.
And when you want to stop proceedings in a court of law, that's the effect of the Supreme Court decision in the Repair versus High Court. Ex parte is Dade Kotupon, this La Trust, case in the Supreme Court in there. So the Supreme Court said we have been misleading, or let's say lawyers have been getting it wrong. When we all graduated, we were told that if you file an application for stay of proceedings, it takes effect. So the judge should stop until the higher court decides otherwise. Mm. But the Supreme Court has made it clear that no, there's no automatic stay of proceedings.
All right.
The judge can continue. But as for stay of execution, it takes effect.
All right. The Supreme Court has also said that if you have an opportunity, like as it was in Parliament, to raise an objection to something, and you don't raise that objection, and the objection is not raised as in timelessly, you lose the opportunity to talk about the fact that, you know, something has been done which ought not to have been done.
So,
is Afenyo not right when he says somebody ought to have raised a question of quorum?
Sam. Yes, you are right. So one of the recent times that this principle you mentioned came up is that Dexter Johnson, where the lawyer didn't raise the objection, well, the Supreme Court said no, Dexter Johnson versus the Republic. There are a number of other cases.
That's right.
Yes. Yes, so Afenyo's point. So that's why I said for me now, we would need the Supreme Court to clarify whether if you don't raise the point, then it's presumed that there is quorum. That one should hold sway over the 138, because now we're being told that, look, to take a decision, you need 138. If you don't have 138, you don't have a quorum. As against the practice that they were using, which is that, look, even 20, Honorable Afenyo mentioned it today, even 20 parliamentarians meet, and then they take a decision.
Yeah.
Nobody says anything. There's no problem. Mm. So the Supreme Court should clarify which is which. Mm. Should we leave Parliament to continue to be masters of their own procedure, which would be better, or we should hold them strictly on Article 104, which obviously, Sam, is creating a lot of problems, because ministers then will have to leave their ministries and come into parliament. At outside the ministry a month ago, the honorable minister had to meet us around 7 a.m. because he said, look, my brother, I can be called at any time to run to parliament to vote. So nowadays, I conduct business 7 a.m. and all that. So I think we really need to have a second look. Let the Supreme Court take a second look, and then we may get something better.
Okay. And that may also reinforce the argument that we need to, deal with the Constitution again, where you need, majority of ministers to come from Parliament. You need to separate it so that this problem is dealt with. But Martin, in 1 minute, are you of the school that says because of e-levy, I'm going to either minimize or stop electronic transactions using Momo?
Oh, Sam, obviously, it is going to apply. I mean, it's obvious. I'm a rational human being. It's going to reduce, even though it can be I can't totally exit Momo, okay. But I certainly will reduce. Yeah, that's how time we see from the beginning. Some of us were of the opinion that government should have started from a lower percentage. 0.5 wouldn't have come this far with all the acrimony, the polarization, and all that. You say 0.5 would have been reasonable. But boom, 1.5, even natural 5, 1.75, and then people had to reel and reel before they came to 1.5. It's too divisive.
Right.
Look, I accept that we need a Marshall Plan. It appears this e-levy is our Marshall Plan. You know, talk of Marshall Plan, remember World War II? After that, Western Europe was going down. So the Americans brought Marshall Plan to revive the economies of Western Europe. I see e-levy as our potential Marshall Plan. But the division, the polarization may not give us what we intend.
Okay. Thank you very much. And like Martin says, when we go to all the countries where this has been introduced, Ghana is the place where we are introducing with such a hefty, percentage to begin with. Mahama Yargan Albert, what did you want to clarify?
Well, I think in my earlier submission about members in the chamber, you see, he misconstrued that to mean that I was suggesting that 20 people or even less were present and taking decision for parliament. You see, the Supreme Court in its ruling and the submission by the Attorney General was talking about members present. You see, being present in
and
parliament
voting.
And voting. And the issue of physical presence in the chamber. Let's get it also straight. Now, Mr. Speaker made an order that you could observe proceedings. We have facilities where you can observe proceedings from your office and participate in that.
You disagree with this position when the earlier decision was taken.
You were so angry about such an
interpretation.
What I'm saying is that...
Yeah, so you shouldn't be going closer to...
I'm saying is that notwithstanding, that is Mr. Speaker's position. That is Mr. Speaker's position.
Okay.
And you
agree with that position
I'm saying that is Mr. Speaker's position. It's not a matter of I agreeing or not now.
I'm talking about the majority.
I'm saying that is the law. We are guided by what we have as a law.
Oh, you went to rescind a decision of the minority on the basis that you can't use this argument. That's what I'm saying.
No. You're getting it wrong. The decision by the minority that we rescinded, it was on the basis that they didn't have the number to proceed because there had been a call for division and they had proceeded to do the count. The vote and proceedings exposed that.
That is taking the exact number present in the chamber.
Not because somebody raised a question of quorum.
Right. If you use the same argument you are, advancing now about people sitting in their offices and the rest of them, then there was a quorum then too.
So the budget was rejected.
At the time, when you rejected that argument.
Samson. The issue of quorum is provided for in our standing orders.
That's right.
Look at Order 48 and read. It's there. I'm saying that until you raise it,
You cannot now say that you will not even use other tools available in Parliament.
All right.
And you are rushing to the Supreme Court.
Okay, thank you. So,
that's the point
I'm making. You are saying that, I mean, this should not happen. Therefore, whichever means you use to stop it, you will stop it, even when it has been passed. That's why you are in court.
Exactly. That's why I'm not even participating in the discussions about implementation.
It's a two-sided house.
No.
There must be views.
I'm not participating.
You must lose at one point.
I'm not participating in the discussion about implementation because I believe we haven't reached there yet.
We are there.
Or we are in the Supreme
Court. We are there.
No, we are in the Supreme Court. We are not at the level of implementation.
Your being in the Supreme Court does not stop the implementation.
My argument is that we will win in the Supreme Court, and so whatever effort you are making to implement will end up being a nullity.
You can't be so sure that you will win in the Supreme Court.
Well, it will be difficult for the Supreme Court not to rule in our favor.
How?
Because in that same case, the Supreme Court recounted the fact that what was also in issue was the budget, and that the majority set aside the budget on the basis of our number. And the argument was that our number was not up to 138, that we were 137, and we didn't constitute a quorum. And therefore, the budget was not properly set aside by us. It's in the facts of that case. The Supreme Court didn't say anything about that. Okay? So today, when the same Supreme Court is confronted with the question of quorum, I doubt if they can say otherwise.
You know, as a lawyer,
you put it to him that they argued the same way in relation to the rejection of the budget, the same argument.
You know, as a lawyer, that every case, however similar two cases the facts may be, are different. In the courtroom, that's why we say every case is taken on its own.
Yes. But you see, it is difficult if you state a principle. Then somebody relies on the principle, and the facts are looking the same, and you don't apply the principle.
Judicial certainty.
Yeah, you create a big issue for the image of the court. So I don't see how the court is going to...
Are you setting the court up for something here? Are you the minority setting the court up for something here?
No, we're asking the court to do its job.
Because you're saying that they cannot hold otherwise.
Yes, because they told us that you need to have a quorum in Parliament. Now, I hear him saying present. And I heard some people say, oh, present is if you come and park at the parking lot of Parliament. How can the parking lot of Parliament show that you are present for the conduct of parliamentary business? How can present be when you come and you are lying in an ambulance outside? How can that be present?
Mm.
Or how can present be when you are sitting in your office and watching? How about if I don't sit in my office, but I lie in my bedroom and log on to Facebook because Parliament is live on Facebook. So if any member of Parliament logs onto Facebook from his bedroom to observe parliamentary proceedings, is he present?
Okay. So before we go back to that discussion, I don't want us to go back to that again.
Just
we have spent quite some time.
Yes, please.
Right. And I'd raise the issue about raising an objection timelessly, but I clearly know, as a matter of fact, that there is no estoppel in constitutional matters.
Exactly. I'm surprised that you're raising this issue that we may exhaust local remedies.
Let him get to that point quickly, and then we'll move on to the next issue.
So I raised the issue of justiciability of the matter, whether or not the court would even have jurisdiction to deal with it.
Okay, so I share the view, like Professor Tuguba, like Professor Aaron Michael Quay, that matters like this are not matters that when they are before the court, we should be shackled from discussing them in the name of getting into contempt.
No.
But I suppose that we may not need to go beyond what we have done.
Don't worry. But there's a point I want to make here, which is the Supreme Court's own ruling.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So I refer to the Marcus Ebeyewa case against ECG and two others. And the Supreme Court referred to Clomega number 2 and said this. With the determination of this case, it is now our expectation that Article 1815 would lend itself to application by the High Court rather than further interpretation by this court. Then the court itself goes further to say,
We might just as well add that legal practitioners in Ghana should take guidance from the above decision and advise their client whenever they are consulted. This will prevent them from rushing to this apex court with a view to turning it into a clearinghouse. We would henceforth no longer countenance this attitude of legal practitioners and parties, for that matter, turning the Supreme Court into a clearinghouse for all matters which appropriately should have been initiated in court lower to the Supreme Court. We dare say that indeed the time has come for this court to crack the whip by ensuring that its jurisdiction in Article 2(1) and 131 of the Constitution, which are frequently invoked by parties, are consistent with previous decided cases on the point. Mm. So all I'm saying is that if you look at the reliefs, I have them here.
Mm. I'm sure we don't want to go.
No, yes, yeah. No, but I'm not a lawyer in the matter. I mean,
you are not a lawyer in the matter.
Okay, very well, I won't go.
That's not also
very
mean
well.
That
okay, very well. I agree with you.
Comment at
I agree with you.
Okay, thank
so
you.
So what I'm saying,
I think it's fair comment. What he's commenting so really doesn't breach anything.
Samson, yeah. What I'm saying is that on if you look at their own reliefs, on each relief they refer to Justice Abdullahi versus Attorney General.
That's right.
What the Supreme Court is telling you and your counsel is that they have already interpreted this. 104 has already been determined. If you think that there is any issue with it, take the ruling, take it to the High Court for enforcement. Use it as a basis. Don't go back to them for interpretation. That is what
For clarification.
But that's what the Supreme Court said in a Sede Yeboa. In any event.
That's why you are here saying it is dead on arrival.
Of course, in any event, you are all parliamentarians. Mm. All three of you are parliamentarians. You know that if you, the decision, the ruling was by Mrs. Speaker. Mm. If you want to challenge Mrs. Speaker's decision, you know what to do.
Okay.
If you are alleging any illegality, you know what to do. So again, you want to now use the Supreme Court as a clearinghouse.
You are talking about exhausting internal procedures.
I am making a point.
As a constitutional matter, will that apply?
Let me make the point.
Okay.
Let me make the point.
It's difficult to make.
It's not difficult.
Yes, I give you a minute because we need to.
You see, you are a parliamentarian in a political space. You decide to abandon your role. Then you are rushing to the Supreme Court. So I believe that what they are doing is setting a bad precedent. Mm. So tomorrow, you go to Supreme Court again, then you may have to be going to the Supreme Court on the student loans.
Did they exercise a role, or did they exercise a right, or they abandoned the role? So if you can use a minute to react to, you said you wanted to react to that.
You see, in this context, I don't think they didn't exercise their right.
They have a right to boycott.
You see, this whole thing about
in bad faith,
exhausting local remedies. You see, where the Constitution says that
the exceptionality of it
should go to another body for a determination and enforcement is different. For instance, the whole chapter on the human rights, the Constitution itself says that even though those provisions are constitutional provisions, if you want their interpretation and enforcement, go to the High Court. You don't just run to the Supreme Court. Mm. It is different from the Article 104(1), which the Constitution, the Supreme Court has interpreted. The fact that it has interpreted it and given it certainty doesn't mean that when somebody breaches it, you cannot come to the court for a declaration that it has been breached.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's what Article 2 is about. Article 2 is saying that you can come to the court for the court to declare that there is a breach of the Constitution.
Thank you.
So we are in court for the court to declare that it was a breach of the constitutional provision.
Thank you very much. And we also need
a determination of the breach.
We also need not to forget the education that even if local remedies are not exhausted and you go to a court, that's not the basis for throwing out the case. It only stays the case until the local remedies have been exhausted. Then the case will continue. Thank you very much. This is Newsfile brought to you by Bank of Africa, strong as a group and close as a partner, MTN everywhere you go. Ashanti University, educating ethical and entrepreneurial leaders for Africa. Robert & Sons Optical Services, your comprehensive eye care service provider for 31 years. Waylead Properties, home is where one starts. CBG, where we stand with you. Edlam Housing, where spacious homes cost less. Duraplas, where Duraplas goes, water flows. And of course, Rehoboth Properties, quality housing for all. And my guest in the studio and on Zoom have been Alexander Kwamina Apenyoma King, MP Efutu and Deputy Majority Leader, Mahama Yarga, MP Boku Central and Member, Constitutional, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee and Delegate, ECOWAS Parliament, Martin Pebu, is a rights activist, legal practitioner. Dr. Kenneth Ashibe is Chief Executive Officer, Ghana Chamber of Telecommunications. And Dr. Theo Echampong, political risk analyst and economist. When we return, Dr. Ken Ashibe will not be with us. So thank you so very much. We'll be right back.
For decades, we have helped businesses connect with their trade partners all over the globe.